Accession number 17576, Reel 4.
I left 16 Parachute Brigade in a hurry in about November 1971 to replace the squadron commander of No. 12 Buccaneer Squadron at Huntington. That was the first Royal Air Force Maritime Buccaneer Squadron, and I was to be the second squadron commander. The one that was to be the second one had just failed the course. So it was a rush job to get me back into flying, having been off for two tours. For that purpose, I went to Manby on the Jet Provost in a very abbreviated course, a second very abbreviated course on the Hunter at Broadie, and a very, very abbreviated course on the Buccaneer at Honington in the winter of 1972. During that time, I can't recall how the squadron... Oh, that's right, the original squadron commander retained command until I was ready to take over in April of 1972. This was a brand new environment to me, overseas operations, maritime operations. I had no acquaintance with that role at all. Nor had I any experience, of course, of the Buccaneer, which had only just come to the Royal Air Force. So all was very new to me. The squadron, No. 12 Squadron, was committed wholly to strike attack, that is, conventional and nuclear deliveries, against shipping. And in addition, we were equipped with the 2-inch rocket and the Lepus flares to attack fast patrol boats, perhaps in the Baltic, both by day and by night. And of course we could deliver our other weapon, the 1,000-pounder, again by day or by night. And the Buccaneer had the capability of both laying down weapons and diving, and in addition, and again new to me, the ability with its Doppler-based navigation and weapons aiming system to toss or loft bombs over distances of 3 or 4 miles, which gave them a degree of security. Although, of course, in the radar clean environment over the sea, we would be detected well out beyond those ranges, and ships' armaments would be brought to bear on us.
Isn't that called the labs technique?
Yes, I'm not...
Delivering nuclear weapons.
Indeed,
well.
Indeed. Yeah. And we would have delivered, or could have delivered, nuclear weapons in that fashion too. But I wasn't in on the earlier labs, and I don't quite know what heights and G parameters were used for those early deliveries. But yes, it's that concept. And we were able to do this both in clear weather and because of the integrated flight system... and very different instrumentation in the Buccaneer to all other conventional Royal Air Force aeroplanes, we were able to do these escape manoeuvres from the deliveries that you have just asked about at night as well. Quite thrilling to do it at night and in cloud with the navigator in the back shouting out the heights as he became more and more worried about it. But as far as I know, we lost no one in these precise but exciting manoeuvres. So the Buccaneer was a thrill in itself with all these options and the oversea operations at very, very low levels. Extended, of course, in range by the inherent range of the Buccaneer with its wing overload tanks, its bomb bay tank, and the possibility of it carrying as an alternative to 4 1,000-pound bombs internally in the fuselage, a huge additional fuel tank. On top of that, of course, we were well rehearsed in air-to-air refueling, with the Victor tanker in particular, and I reinstituted on the squadron the buddy-buddy tanking facility between Buccaneers. So range was almost limitless on the Buccaneer and allowed us to go into strange waters, into the Arctic and the Atlantic.
Buddy-buddy, it was a system of one Buccaneer fueling another one.
Indeed it was. Yeah. And that again was quite exciting in the closeness one had to get to the tanker Buccaneer. But we all learned how to do that, again by day and by night. It had no self-protection weapon, or indeed at that time, self-protection, ECM, chaff or flares. Later in its life, of course, it had all these additions, they were long overdue. But during my time, we had neither these protection assets, nor did we have, other than the ability to deliver weapons in the loft or toss manoeuvre, any standoff capability, though this capability was emerging with initially the Martel missile and latterly, and still current on the Tornado, the Sea Eagle missile, which gave a standoff capability. The navigation was based, as I say, on a Doppler system and integrated with the Blue Parrot radar optimized for anti-shipping operations. So we had a formidable vehicle, very much loved, getting a bit old and not very serviceable for all its complications, but a much loved aeroplane and a very exciting role. What I found, however, when I arrived on 12 Squadron was a very low experience level a paucity of both experienced executives and of weapons specialists. Indeed, I think I only had two weapons specialists in my time, one of whom was detached for much of that. As to executives, one had come from the V Force and had no previous Buccaneer experience, as far as I remember. Neither had the senior flight commander, who preceded me onto the squadron by a matter of weeks. He'd come from the Canberra Force, and he too was brand new. So for a squadron which operated for 24 hours a day, and we trained with day and night shifts, I had two flying squadron leaders of those experience levels and myself brand new to the role. So one of my first jobs was to bring up new leaders who could be given authorization status so that we could enhance our command and control at squadron level. On the first, I think, week of my tenure, I took the squadron out to Gioia del Colle, now well in the news with the Bosnia operation, in order to take part in a NATO maritime exercise in the Mediterranean. And this was one of very many such exercises for a squadron that was in so much demand for its versatility and capability, and indeed the only one in the Royal Air Force at that time with that role. There was still a Royal Navy squadron of Buccaneers operating in the next hangar to ours, land-based at Honington. They were far better experienced, not unreasonably, having six or seven weapons instructors and many lieutenant commanders. But incidentally, a lieutenant commander... No, was he a lieutenant commander boss? I've got a feeling that he was, but I'm not sure about that. But that squadron, very much better equipped to do the job than we were at that time, though we were learning fast. A very heavily committed squadron. I don't recall having a full weekend off during my time, but my time was very short because some 3 months after arriving on the squadron, my wingman flew into the sea, and after the subsequent Board of Inquiry, I was relieved of my command. We're not sure why my wingman did fly into the sea. It could have been for a number of reasons, but I think at least indirectly, if not directly, I was held to blame, and a new squadron commander had to be had to be found. I think that 1972 was an interesting year in this context, in that I joined a large band of sacked squadron commanders and station commanders, the rule being, I think, that any accident must be attributed to one of the executives. Of course, I was more closely associated in my case, since I was involved directly in that particular flying accident. Perhaps later, the economy of sacking bosses for accidents was called into question, even if only on the sheer economy of having to regenerate executives, many from staff appointments, with all the refresher flying and conversion flying that was involved. In any event, I was posted after a brief course on weapons effectiveness to the Ministry of Defence to look after the operational training of the fast jet force from whence I had come. I was based in Adastral House, remote from the main building of the Ministry of Defence, and there I looked after all the operational training to which I've referred, and this lasted for some 2 years before I was sent to the National Defence College at Latimer for a year's staff training before resuming flying, this time with the Jaguar Force, a proper refresher course given again on the Hunter at Broadie, but only a short conversion to the Jaguar on the OCU, Operational Conversion Unit at Lossiemouth, before taking over the post of Wing Commander Operations at the very big strike attack Jaguar base then forming at Royal Air Force Bruggen. I arrived there in April of 1977 to a base which had been almost completely rebuilt under the eagle eye of my excellent predecessor. The base was one of the first to be fully hardened, with aircraft to be accommodated in hardened aircraft shelters in the four corners of the airfield at Bruggen, to accommodate four big Jaguar squadrons, 15 each at their peak, with a combat operations centre, again fully hardened and filtered for the command and control of the wing, which is where I would spend much of my time, with the station commander, to whom I was number two. And additionally, there were hardened and filtered facilities for all the pilots, the pilot briefing facilities, PBFs, and a very large QRA, quick reaction alert force compound at one corner of the airfield.
The filtering facilities, what, filtering the air?
Filtering the air to be fully survivable in a nuclear, bacteriological and chemical environment. Incidentally, on that, we never relied fully on the filtration plants. At any time, there was a suspected exercise only, of course, nuclear or bacteriological or chemical attack. We donned respirators and stayed in respirators, doing our work, whatever it be, until the panic had subsided. But I digress and get ahead of myself. The airfield was therefore optimised for contemporary operations and indeed was envied by all around us from all the nations of the now second Allied Tactical Air Force. We were in the strike and attack role, as I've said, and this was unprecedented in the Royal Air Force for a single-seat aircraft. In the past, nuclear operations had always been conducted with two men in the crew, with all the validation processes that are involved here. So it was particularly demanding for this single seat force to be prepared and extremely well rehearsed in nuclear as well as conventional operations.
These were tactical nuclear weapons. These
are, indeed they are.
Yeah.
I won't go, indeed I can't easily remember the complex procedures that were required both at my level of command and control, flight line level and above us. Suffice it to say that the nuclear operations took up a great deal of our time, were checked and double-checked continuously at our level and by the tactical evaluation team, and we could never afford to get it wrong, nor do I believe that we ever did. I think perhaps one pilot was below standard on one evaluation and he had to recategorize later after considerable retraining. But it is amazing to me now how well the single-seat crews coped with this additional burden.
What you're saying is that one man was in charge of two safety catches that would otherwise obtain on a Polaris submarine, for instance.
Well, that's right. We're getting into areas that I can't easily recall, but you're talking about that sort of problem.
He had sole responsibility to release the weapon.
In the final analysis, yes. But validation was carried out on the ground between him and other officers before he got airborne. But of course, once he was airborne, his finger was on the trigger, and subject to recall orders, which were again rehearsed frequently, he would go ahead and carry out his mission as released. But
they were relatively low-yield weapons.
Yes, relatively low-yield. And for specific targets, pre-planned targets or ad hoc targets, of course, if they came up and were directed by higher authority.
I mean, were you aware of the yield? Was it about 10 kilotons?
I can't remember the yield figures at all. I'm not being coy, I just can't remember them.
Did you have much to do with it? I mean, when the aircraft were armed, presumably there was a total nuclear unit that looked after the store.
Yes.
Fitted them to the bomb bays.
Yes.
Fused them, did everything.
Yes. Yes.
Without you knowing the details.
Well, I knew what they were doing out there with the keys. There's no secret about that. And how the keys were handed over and how the checking procedures were carried out. I knew all this, but naturally I wasn't involved in the detail. This was carried out by qualified officers for that purpose. But there was no, or very little risk. No one could imagine how the procedures could have been abused and a weapon be released for delivery, accidentally or on purpose by a man who had lost his wits.
Presumably the training you did and the scenarios you rehearsed for were very similar to those that you did in your photographic reconnaissance days.
Well, yes and no.
You were targeted to certain units and did dummy attacks and this sort of thing? Or?
Yes, yeah. We had simulated attack profiles and simulated strike profiles, which would reflect the wartime missions as they were envisaged. Yes, exactly so. Indeed, it would be futile to train in any other way. My very dynamic, impressive experienced station commander had a notice put up at Bruggen, which I see has been since taken down, saying our purpose is to train for war, and don't you forget it. Everything that was done at Bruggen was done to that end. Everything was totally realistic, as will be borne out by what I tell you in a moment on the evaluations. But before I do that, perhaps I should mention the conventional options and the aeroplane itself. The Jaguar was fairly limited in its weapons. It had two effective guns, 30mm Aden guns. God, I'm sure they were Aden guns. Or were we into Mausers at that stage? No, we were into Aden guns. So well proven by that stage. And the 1,000-pound bomb for again delivery either by lay down, dive, which is a pretty vulnerable delivery option, or by toft and loss, as with the Buccaneer I described.
What do you mean by lay down?
That is a retard bomb, which you can lay down at very low levels, 100, 200 feet, and continue to escape whilst the bomb itself is retarded before it explodes. Mm-hmm. So we had those options, but otherwise no weapons, and particularly at that stage, no standoff capability beyond tossing or lofting a bomb. And this is a matter, and was then, of great regret. The cluster bomb unit was the other anti-armour, anti-personnel weapon for use in support of ground forces. But otherwise, nothing else, and indeed we could not even loft or toss those. So that would be a vulnerable delivery too. And now I was starting to get very agitated about the lack of standoff weapons and the risks that were being taken, therefore unnecessarily at this stage of the art, by the Jaguar force. The Jaguar itself had been developed, of course, from a training aeroplane, and with wonderful and typical British innovation, we had made it into a very successful ground attack aircraft for day operations only then. And of course, since then, and fully operational now in 1997, an even more effective aircraft, capable of better operations at night with night vision goggles, and a better inertial navigation system, and new weapons coming along. But at that stage, not only did we not have a standoff capability of any effective sort, but neither did we have any self-protection, which could have been available by this stage. And again, I refer to chaff and flares. And I'll come back to that in a moment after I've described our great success on the international stage, even without those adjuncts. I've talked about Tacheval, and Tacheval at Bruggen by that time involved three categories of evaluation. Alert and readiness, operations, support functions or logistics, and survival to operate, our capability to operate in our new facilities, hardened and filtered. We were the first wing, despite the complexity of everything, and incidentally I forgot to add that we had a surface-to-air missile site and headquarters on the eastern side of the airfield. They were developed Bloodhound missiles, and we had our own organic short-range missile, the Rapier, on a RAF regiment squadron. Evaluating all these elements on the base at Bruggen, we were the first to be given gradings of one in all four of those categories. We were certainly the first, we may even be the only base, but I suspect others did follow us, to achieve those distinctions. And we managed to do that without those self-protection measures, which then came in immediately afterwards as mandatory requirements for the top gradings. So what we faced there was the accolade, which could not be improved on, and indeed in future could not be reached unless we were given self-protection measures, at least those that I have talked about. There were none in the pipeline at that stage which could have reached us within the immediate foreseeable future. And this is a matter, again, of very great regret, since they were relatively simple additions to the armoury, in inverted commas, which self-protection is part of. Therefore, we set ourselves the task of a self-help appendage to the Jaguar, made up in our own workshops without any authority, and certainly covertly, since staffs would not have liked to have heard about it, simply in an attempt to retain the gradings that we had achieved, both for ourselves and indeed for the nation. With great ingenuity and led by the hierarchy on the station and unknown to the staffs, we did in fact trial a chaff installation which might have given us or regained us the marks we'd achieved. It was not in fact put to the test because the next tack eval during my time was cancelled. But it seems appalling to me that the flight line, as busy as it was, should have had to go to these lengths at this time to produce basic self-protection measures. This was not the only occasion on which Bruggen took the initiative. Without naming names, about 4 years later, irritated that no progress had been made to give the Jaguar force a self-protection air-to-air missile of the Sidewinder variety, and Sidewinder would indeed have sufficed, Bruggen again took it upon themselves to suggest and even build a mock-up of a Sidewinder fit for the Jaguar, again without support, even the knowledge of staffs. Now, of course, as you know, the Jaguar has both chaff and flares and a Sidewinder missile mounted overwing on all its operational aircraft. So we lacked on that most excellent wing, which had achieved the best possible ratings, standoff weapons, which could have been with us, ECM provision, chaff and flares, and a self-protection air-to-air missile. Notwithstanding the extraordinary enthusiasm, enterprise, and hard work of the Bruggen wing stands out in my memory, and perhaps that was my greatest flying appointment. Stop it for a moment. The Jaguar for a moment. Again, you will know that it is now considered a very effective aircraft and is very popular with its pilots, with all the enhancements that have been included. Even then, of course, it was a very popular aircraft and was becoming more serviceable the while. It had long legs. You had to watch its manoeuvrability, particularly in the difficult terrain of the Saarland or the Harz, particularly at so slow speeds when the angle of attack could run away with you, and particularly if you were on single engine operations, because again the angle of attack could be critical and crucial very quickly. Well, only in returning, because obviously you wouldn't continue with a heavy load into a hostile environment on one, but you might very well have to come back on one. And then you would have to watch the manoeuvrability very carefully, and indeed your landing. We have lost Jaguars getting behind the drag curve on single engine, allowing the angle of attack to increase to a point where the aircraft becomes out of control. But that, I mean, providing you stick to the rules with the Jaguar, then there is no problem. And it became an increasingly popular aircraft. There is one interesting facet of our operation, or dichotomy, at Bruggen between two of the squadrons at opposite ends of the airfield regarding the navigation kit, which, when it worked perfectly, would give most excellent navigation and weapons aiming capability. One squadron would refuse to fly unless this kit was perfect, and received as a reward very high scores and very high marks in academic competition. The other squadron recognized that they might very well have to operate without kit at perfection in war, and concentrated on what we call the reversionary modes should the kit not be fully proficient. It's an interesting philosophy, and I take no sides in deciding which squadron had it right.